hardball hitting with a baseball bat. Kick up your heels, kid, and leave them all flat. What does it mean to be American?
This is Democracy Optimist. For some perspective on where the right to vote stands in America right now, with just weeks to go before a general election that seems mighty consequential to the nature of the American future, we take you back to a pivotal moment in the nation's history.
I speak tonight for the dignity of man and the destiny of democracy.
It was the night of March 15, 1965. President Lyndon Johnson was before a joint session of Congress, members of both the House and Senate filling the House chamber, to spell out his proposal for what would become the Voting Rights Act of 1965.
This bill will strike down restrictions to voting in all elections. Federal, state, and local. Which have been used to deny Negroes the right to vote. This bill will establish a simple, uniform standard which cannot be used, however ingenious the effort to flout our Constitution. It will provide for citizens to be registered by officials of the United States government. If the state officials refuse to register them, it will eliminate tedious, unnecessary lawsuits which delay the right to vote. Finally, this legislation will ensure that properly registered individuals are not prohibited from voting. I will welcome the suggestions from all the members of Congress. I have no doubt that I will get some on ways and means to strengthen this law and to make it effective. But experience has plainly shown that this is the only path to carry out the command of the Constitution. To those who seek to avoid action by their national government in their home communities, who want to and who seek to maintain purely local control over elections, the answer is simple. Open your polling places to all your people. Allow men and women to register and vote, whatever the color of their skin. Extend the rights of citizenship to every citizen of this land. There is no constitutional issue here. The command of the Constitution is plain. There is no moral issue. It is wrong, deadly wrong, to deny any of your fellow Americans the right to vote in this country.
President Lyndon Johnson making his pitch to a joint session of Congress for passage of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. It was passed by the Senate 77-19 and then by the House by a margin of 333-85. It then went to the White House where Johnson signed the bill into law on August 6, 1965. Here's your host, Professor Joshua Douglas of the University of Kentucky Rosenberg College of Law. Josh, give us a timeline here. Tell us how Supreme Court decisions have impacted the Voting Rights Act since it passed in 1965. And let's start with the court's actions regarding Section 5 of the law, and that requires jurisdictions with a history of discrimination to get the approval of the Justice Department or a court before changing voting rules. What has happened to Section 5?
Yeah, there's a long and kind of convoluted history here. As you noted, Congress, when it passed the Voting Rights Act in 1965, included this provision as almost an emergency measure to say there are certain states, certain jurisdictions that were discriminating on the basis of race in their voting rules. And, you know, someone would sue about it. It would take a long time for litigation to proceed. And then even if the court struck down a particular practice, say a literacy test, then the jurisdiction would just tweak the literacy test or whatever it was that was discriminatory and do it again for the next elections. So Congress said, let's put a stop to all of this. Stop jurisdictions in their tracks from passing a new law until the jurisdiction explained or demonstrated that the new voting rule would not have a disproportionate impact on minority voters. But the other thing Congress said when it first passed this provision in 1965 is that it should be a temporary measure. And so it said in 5 years from now, the portion, this Section 5, would expire. And there was a lawsuit immediately in a Supreme Court case called South Carolina versus Katzenbach in 1966, I believe it was. The court said, this provision is upheld. It upheld the Section 5 mechanism. And then 5 years later in 1970, Congress reauthorized the act and extended it for five more years. In 75, it reauthorized it again for 7 years. In 1982, it did it again and said, this time we're going to extend it for 25 years. And then in 2006, Congress once again, facing the expiration of Section 5 a year later, reauthorized it once again for 25 years. And every time Congress did this, it extended the length that Section 5 would be in force. There was a Supreme Court case, and the Supreme Court upheld it until the Shelby County case in 2013. Mm. And in that case, in a 5-4 decision, the Supreme Court basically said, look, the time has come to end this oversight of mostly Southern jurisdictions. The court said that the formula Congress used to decide which states had to get this pre-approval, or known as pre-clearance, the formula was outdated because Congress was relying on older data when it reauthorized the act in 2006. So ultimately, it struck down this provision of the Voting Rights Act. Technically, the formula that Congress decided which states were covered, but the practical effect is that it gutted the use of Section 5. And so now there are no covered jurisdictions that need to seek pre-approval unless a court affirmatively says you're trying to discriminate. And so there's another provision that lets a court put a jurisdiction under the law, but that's not going on anytime right now.
Well, in 2021, the court said something about another part of the act, Section 2. Section 2 allows people to sue, either on their own behalf or with the help of the Justice Department, to undo existing laws and procedures that would deny equal political opportunity to voters to elect their candidates of choice. So how did the Supreme Court impact Section 2?
So this was a case called Brnovich versus DNC, Democratic National Committee, that challenged two provisions of Arizona law for their disproportionate impact on minority voters. The first was about voters who show up to the wrong precinct and cast a provisional ballot. The second was about ballot collection, sometimes referred to as ballot harvesting, where you could get someone else to pick up your completed ballot and deliver it. And the plaintiffs showed that these two laws had a small but statistically significant impact on minority voters. And so it was a challenge under, as you said, Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, which prohibits states from enacting rules that have a discriminatory effect. Well, Justice Alito for a 5-4 court rejected the challenge, rejected the challenge to the Arizona laws, upheld the laws, but he did something even more meaningful with respect to Section 2 of the Act. He said that a plaintiff who wants to bring a challenge to a voting rule under Section 2 because it has a discriminatory effect on minority voters has to satisfy 5 so-called guideposts, he put it. And he created 5 rules, essentially, that plaintiffs have to prove to win a lawsuit under Section 2. And every single one of these guideposts actually make it harder for plaintiffs to win. He said things like, if a law is longstanding, if it's been around for a long time, if it was around in 1982, the last time that Congress amended the Voting Rights Act, then we're going to presume it's okay today, even if perhaps things have changed in the way that the state runs its elections. Another guidepost is that if there are other easy ways to vote, then maybe we're not so worried about the one type of voting rule that the plaintiffs are challenging. So in many ways, he kind of gutted Section 2, much in the same way that the Supreme Court gutted Section 5 in that Shelby County case, by creating these guideposts that make it really hard for plaintiffs to win their case.
Now, there was an Alabama case that went before the justices, and in that case, the court said the state had to redraw its maps. What did it say about the Voting Rights Act in that case?
So this was a challenge under Section 2, that same provision, but instead of challenging a voting rule, it challenged a redistricting map for not giving enough minority representation. So essentially, Alabama has 7 congressional districts, and the way the map was drawn was that there was only one district in which a majority of the people identified as a minority race. We call this a majority-minority district. So 1 of 7 was a district where Black individuals were a majority and could control, essentially, elect a candidate of choice, is the way the law puts it. But in Alabama, about 35% of the population identifies as Black individuals. So just mathematically, you would think that if you're giving kind of a fair map with equal representation for all, there would be 2 of the 7 districts, assuming that minority individuals all kind of live in the same geographic area, which they do in Alabama. And so this was a challenge under Section 2 for what's known as vote dilution, or basically the way the map was drawn that was gerrymandered to make it harder for minority individuals to elect a candidate of choice. And the Supreme Court agreed. The Supreme Court said, yeah, if you look at the case law in this old case from 1986 called Thornburg versus Jingles, which is the precedent for challenging a map for diluting the strength of minority voters, Alabama was asking the court to overturn that, and the Supreme Court rejected that. And so it did uphold the challenge and struck down the map and said, Alabama, you've got to redraw your map. Now, 2 really interesting things about this, however. The first is that the court was asked to make Alabama redraw the map before the 2022 election. A lower court had struck down the map, said it was unlawful under the Voting Rights Act. Alabama challenged that to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court put that lower court decision on hold and basically said, Alabama, you can use the map in 2022. And then eventually the court strikes down the map. And so Alabama voted under a map that was ultimately illegal in the last election. The other thing that's interesting here is that Justice Brett Kavanaugh wrote a concurring opinion, and his was the 5th vote. I tell my students, how do you win at the Supreme Court? You count to 5. You need 5 votes for a majority. Kavanaugh was the 5th vote. And in his separate opinion, he said, well, I agree with the majority, but I think there would be a really good argument to say that Section 2 has lived long enough, that we should strike down the use of Section 2, just like the court did in the Shelby County decision on Section 5. So although it was a so-called victory for the voting rights plaintiffs, there's a lot of things in that opinion that are making people nervous with respect to the efficacy of Section 2 moving forward.
Are there any actions that could impact the Voting Rights Act that are currently in the pipeline that leads to the Supreme Court ultimately? Any cases you're watching?
Yeah, there's a really interesting and, in my view, concerning case that the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals just decided. So here's what happened. In that 2021 Section 2 case I mentioned, a case called Brnovich about Arizona's rules in which Justice Alito created these five so-called guideposts, Justice Gorsuch wrote a separate opinion. And he wrote and said, I write to flag one thing that none of the parties have raised. And the thing he flagged was whether private plaintiffs are even allowed to bring lawsuits at all under Section 2. The lawyers know this is referred to as a private right of action. Essentially, the law sets up a regime that says you can't discriminate on the basis of race in voting rules, but who can actually file a lawsuit to use that section of the Voting Rights Act? And for the 4 or 5 decades that people have been suing under Section 2, people have always assumed and sort of recognized that private plaintiffs can do so. In fact, one study showed that 98% of all Section 2 cases were brought by private plaintiffs, not the Department of Justice. Well, Gorsuch said, I write to flag this one thing. And he said lower courts, plural, have left it as an open question. But then he only cited one lower court case from 1980. So it was a little strange. And in some of my scholarship, I actually did a deep dive into this and found that the case he cited didn't really support his proposition that courts have left it an open question. But even so, in a case in Arkansas, a federal district court, that is the trial court, said, you know, what Gorsuch said was interesting. And that judge ruled that private plaintiffs, like the NAACP in that case that brings a lot of lawsuits, is not allowed to be a plaintiff. And then an Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals panel, that is a 3-judge court of the Court of Appeals, agreed with that lower court judge and said, yeah, Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act does not allow a private plaintiff to bring suit. Now, think about the implications of this. As I noted, 98% of these lawsuits filed under Section 2, whether it comes to redistricting maps or challenges to voting rules that have an impact on minority voters, 98% of those lawsuits are brought by private plaintiffs like the NAACP. So if you take that away, say they're not allowed to do so, then what's left? Well, the Department of Justice is going to have to try to bring whatever lawsuits it can, but it doesn't have the kinds of resources. So this could be really concerning for invoking and using the Voting Rights Act. Now, the plaintiffs in that case could have taken that case to the U.S. Supreme Court. They decided not to. And one reason, I think, is they were concerned about a ruling that would apply nationwide that says private plaintiffs can't bring a case. But right now in the 7 states that comprise the Eighth Circuit, including Arkansas, you can't file suit under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act if you're a private entity. Only the Department of Justice can do so. Now, the plaintiffs say, well, we can use another statute, the Civil Rights Act. But it's concerning to me, I think, that this court has cut out a major portion of the Voting Rights Act by narrowing who's allowed to sue. And I think this issue will eventually reach the U.S. Supreme Court.
Well, taking all of this into consideration and other things that have happened, how do voting rights today differ from just after the Voting Rights Act of 65 took effect across the country?
I think it's a mixed bag, because if you look at the state of Voting Rights Act just after 1965 passage, well, you'd say that the act hadn't done all of its work yet, right? There were still disparities in who had the opportunity to vote. And yet the act was so powerful in equalizing the playing field, in opening the doors, particularly to minority participation, and in eliminating some of those ridiculous rules that states had for registering, things like tell me how many bubbles there are in a bar of soap. But of course, only Black individuals in the South were asked to answer that impossible task to be able to register. I actually give my students in my voting rights class the 1964 literacy test that Louisiana once gave. And it's impossible for any person to pass, but of course, only minority individuals were given it. So right after the act, we were trying to fix all those problems, and it was a huge success. Today, we can look back and say, okay, we don't have the same kinds of disparities, but what we do have is what Justice Ginsburg referred to as second-generation barriers, things that aren't as explicit in terms of targeting race, but when you dive down, you can see the effects they have. Challenges to the number of drop boxes that are allowed to be put in communities when, if we say, you know, only one drop box per county, well, that obviously has a big effect in the larger cities where minorities tend to live. You see these rules in like places like Georgia or Ohio. You know, and Justice Ginsburg wrote in her dissent in that Shelby County case, throwing away parts of the Voting Rights Act is like throwing away your umbrella during a rainstorm because you're not getting wet. So now this series of Supreme Court cases has thrown away parts of the Voting Rights Act. And what we're seeing now is this retrenchment. States passing these rules, they're not explicitly race-based, but they do often have an effect on minority voters.
Over the course of our Democracy Optimist series, Josh Douglas has posed this question to our guests.
Why should people vote?
While everyone had an opinion, here are some examples of what we heard from five of our guests about exercising your right to vote. Gene Schrodel, professor of political science and public policy at Claremont Graduate University and author of Voting in Indian Country, The View from the Trenches.
It affects your lives in extraordinary ways. Internationally, position of the United States in the world, domestically, if you're female or male, how about your privacy rights, whether you control your fertility or not? Yeah, it's just mind-boggling to me that people wouldn't vote.
UCLA law professor Richard Hasen.
Well, aside from the fact that it is one of the powers that we the people have to help to choose our leaders, we're not just choosing a president. So, if you live in a local area, you might have much more influence, not over who the president's going to be, but who's going to be on your city council, who's going to be on your county board of supervisors, or in your state representatives. These people make decisions that affect all of our lives, and they are responsive to what voters want. This is one of the things that we know, is that politicians want to be reelected. They want their policies to be put in place. They want the support of voters. And so we shouldn't think of this as only about the U.S. presidential election. That, of course, gets so much more attention than everything else. But we're voting. We in the United States vote on more offices than anywhere else in the world. I mean, we just have so many elections. And that means there's lots of room to be able to have a voice in who is going to help to govern us.
There are so many reasons to vote.
Lauren Kunis, the Chief Executive Officer and Executive Director of Vote Writers.
Voting is your chance to have a say, and it's your say on everything from the big picture policy, top of the ticket, but also there are really important decisions to be made at the state and local level. You know, a lot of times, as you noted, if you're not in a state that is in play in the presidential race, what should drive you to the ballot box in addition to, you know, fulfilling your democratic right as a citizen is having a say on who is elected to the school board and whether or not the pothole on your street should get fixed. And lots of important issues are decided in every single election. I always tell folks as well, too many people worked too hard to get us to this point to sit out any election.
David Becker is the executive director and founder of the nonpartisan nonprofit Center for Election Innovation and Research.
Those votes make a difference even when we lose. We're showing our investment in our society, our democratic society, governing itself well. And by expressing ourselves, even in margins where we lose, we let the winner of that election know we're here and we have some disagreements on policy. So that person can take that into account. It is just so important not only to vote, but to vote all the way down the ballot, to do the research on these things where you can express to people at the local level as well as the federal level that you're watching, you're interested in making sure that our society, our governance of our society works, and you're going to be there for the next election.
And Deborah Grainer, in 2019, Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear granted voting rights to thousands of people convicted of crimes, and she was one of those people.
I don't know why people don't vote. I don't know why there's such apathy and such disinterest, or I get a little tired of hearing, well, my vote doesn't count. Well, when your vote's been taken away, you know how much your vote counts. Whether or not everything that you vote for or against doesn't turn out the way you want it, it's still an integral part of being a citizen of the United States. And I believe that everybody should be encouraged, and if they don't know, to get some kind of education around why it is so important to vote. And it's the only way that we can really participate in our democracy is to be part of the voting public.
This is One Nation. What happens in Selma or in Cincinnati is a matter of legitimate concern to every American. But let each of us look within our own hearts and our own communities. And let each of us put our shoulder to the wheel to root out injustice wherever it exists.
Thanks for joining us for this series of conversations about how elections work, about the value of your vote, and about challenges to your right and freedom to make choices at your local polling place. Find our series online at democracyoptimist.com. Joshua Douglas, writer and host, Mike Savage, executive producer. I'm Tom Martin, your series producer. Neil Kesterson, technical director and sound designer. Democracy Optimist theme song, American, by Madeline Peru. Mason Graber and Stephen Dabney, research assistants, Caitlin Douglas, graphic designer, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. Democracy Optimist is a special Eastern Standard series produced by Dynamics Productions for Richmond, Kentucky-based public radio station WEKU.